As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
Hi, I'm Matt Lieb.
And I'm Vince Mancini.
And this is
Pod Yourself a Gun,
a Sopranos podcast where Vince Mancini and I go through every single episode of The Sopranos and
talk about it.
Thank you so much for listening. Once again, just reminding you to give us 5 stars and leave a review on the old, on the old podcast machine app. We would appreciate it. I ask you to do it every week, and every week you fail me. So let this be the week you decide not to fail me and do that. Also, patreon.com/fraudcast, the $8 tier gets you a shout out at the end of the pod. And we actually do have a new patron who decided to go for the $8 tier today. And we will say your name at the end of the show.
I hope you're listening, bud, because today's your lucky day.
Although it would be sick if you weren't listening, if you were like, nah, you just deserve $8, you know?
Yeah, true.
That'd be sick. Yeah. You know, more people should do that.
Like an anonymous benefactor. I like it.
Yeah, like we need a Miss Havisham, you know? We need this is what this podcast needs, a Miss Havisham. That would be sick. All right. Although I guess she really wasn't the benefactor, right?
No, it was the criminal guy.
It was
right?
Robert De Niro the whole time.
Yeah.
I saw the movie. Who wrote that movie? Doesn't matter. Anyways, today our guest is a very, very special man from a very, very special podcast, from the What a Time to Be Alive podcast. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome Patrick Monahan.
Hello.
Hey, what's up, buddy?
Not much. I just want to say the description, it was Robert De Niro the whole time, could also be used to describe the film Angel Heart, for those who are not familiar.
Oh, I don't know Angel Heart. What happened? What's that about?
That's where he, I don't want to spoil it too badly. It's also 30 years old, has Mickey Rourke when he was still like a handsome guy. It's where he, Robert De Niro plays a weird, mysterious guy in a suit with long hair and like long fingernails, like pointy fingernails, named Louis Cipher. And it turns out that he's the devil.
So, he was the devil the whole time?
He was the devil the whole time.
So. Oh, shit. Oh, that man. Sucks.
Al Pacino sort of just fucking ripping off De Niro again in whatever the one where he was the devil for Keanu Reeves.
Oh, yeah. The Devil's Advocate.
Yeah, that's the one.
I saw that one. I like it. Louis Cipher. That's good.
Yeah.
That's like in Scream. Or no, what was it? It was like, I still know what you did last summer when you found out the guy is the killer because his last name is Benson, and then he just looks and he goes, Ben's son. And like he explains his last name. He's like, oh, because Ben was the killer in the first one. I love good writing. Speaking of good writing, Patrick, you are a fan of The Sopranos. Am I wrong?
You are not wrong. You almost caught me there. I almost said yes, but that would have been yes. I'm a fan of The Sopranos. Correct.
Yeah. So,
do you have any like Guido experience in your own life that would make the show extra hit close to home?
Let's see. I am 100% Irish, but my my dad is from
Bay
Ridge.
Hold on. This podcast is over. You didn't tell us that beforehand.
I know.
We got an Irishman here. I'm sorry.
I can't. Yeah, I can't be. I can never be made and all, et cetera. I know. It's a bummer. Oh, but
that sucks.
So my dad grew up in Bay Ridge. We basically only went to Italian restaurants. That's like the only food that we ever went. Like, so we have this sort of, Italian is very important. He had friends who were like, you know, guys from that part of the city and stuff. So, yeah, I know where we got the good cannolis and, you know, and like the special, you know, like put it this way. We went to a restaurant and one time, we were like, so, you know, regulars and stuff. And they had special sausage they got just for us from their meat provider. Mm-hmm. And they made it for us. And somebody at their table was like, oh, can I have what they're having? And they said, oh, no, they brought their own sausage. So you can't have it.
God damn.
He got the special sausage. How come the Irish didn't like come here and open restaurants when they emigrated? It seems
that's a great question.
Did that happen, or like was it just too early for there to be restaurants? Seems like everybody,
I think they were all too poor to have food that people wanted to eat other than them. I don't know. That's a good question.
Just too associated with famine in the public mind.
Yeah, it's like if there was like an Irish Olive Garden, it would be like, when you're here, you're thinking about death. Or like, you know, when you're here, you've frozen out some portion of your family. That's kind of it, I think.
When you're here, you're escaping your family.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just the salad and breadsticks cost money, but the despair is unlimited, which is nice. So did you, is Soprano something you watched while it was airing, or did you kind of catch on to it late?
It ended, I watched it in a group in college kind of towards the middle end of the run. I can't remember exactly how it lines up, because I know it kind of, the season started getting stretched out and it was coming out half at a time and stuff
But
I remember in college like watching, you know, Tony like looking out at the waves at the beach house by himself in the winter. So like it was that kind of era of the show.
Yeah.
And that was like my junior senior year of college maybe. So
yeah,
I watched it, and then I went back and watched the beginning kind of all in a, and I always got the DVDs for Christmas on whenever they came out. So that was I have them all now too. So
yeah. It is you were describing something from the end of this season, I believe, which no spoilers. Although we do a lot of spoilers on the show.
But, I don't know. He did a lot of staring out at the waves. Like he did that last season a couple times.
No, but he said specific to Beach House, did he not? We won't get into but we will eventually.
It's been long enough that I don't remember, so yeah, why not?
Well, we'll get into a little bit later. But first, let's get into this podcast. And before we do, we must, of course, play the theme song.
Pod.
Your mama always said you'd be the chosen
pod. Pod.
You got to burn the shine.
Under a podcast.
Blue moon in your eyes.
Pod. 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 Podcast. It's seamless.
Thank you. So today we are going to be talking about, from season 4, episode 4 of The Sopranos, The Wait, which premiered on October 6th, 2002. Vince, why don't you let us know what the synopsis is according to, IMDb.
A joke sparks a series of hit contracts while Carmela finds herself happier than perhaps she should be that Furio will be around for good.
I like that you're pronouncing it Furio.
Hey, Furio.
Yeah, instead of Furio, which is the way everyone else pronounces it on the show. Yeah. So what was happening during this time in America when this episode came out?
Yeah, you know, you can't evaluate art without acknowledging its cultural context, and that's why we got to take the Remember When machine.
Walk, walk, Daddy, Daddy, Bob, Bob, Shoebop. We're the Northern. Then.
Remember.
Remember when it's the lowest form of conversation.
So, what do we say? October 6, 2002. A lot of things were going on. I tried to pick some stories that would have a little relevance to today. And
to this episode specifically?
Yeah, well, just for this time period today.
Oh, sure.
From the New York Times, this was October 6, 2002. Schoolyard superstar aims for a second act as an adult. And it's about none other than Britney Spears. And
what?
Yeah. Britney Spears, the pop star who brought sizzle to the schoolyard with glitter t-shirts and short shorts, strode onto a Milan runway last Tuesday evening in a $23,000 rainbow spangled gown by Donatella Versace. You know, she's turning 21. She's trying to reinvent herself as an adult. Spears, who made her debut as a wholesome bubblegum star with a penchant for sweetly flashing her belly button, is caught in a vicious conundrum of fame.
Why is it written like this?
It's New York Times.
It's getting weird. But
a vicious conundrum of fame acquired young. The qualities that made her accessible and popular as a teenage star may be precisely the ones choking her career as an adult, leaving her looking like an unseemly parody as she tries to become a grown-up recording artist.
I mean, it's like, it's interesting that I think this is, you did pick a very relevant thing to our time period in which we are totally reevaluating coverage of Britney Spears back in the day. Like this has it all. It has infantilizing her and, being weirdly horny for her at the same time.
It gets a little better. I mean, this is tracking the beginnings of the backlash against the sort of celebrity production machine. From the looks of things, the Britney backlash has been picking up speed. A website is devoted to tracking what appears to be the fluctuating size of her breasts. Two executives who have worked with Ms. Spears say they were dismayed to see insinuations in the tabloids that she is facing a Mariah Carey-like emotional breakdown.
God, that's just... The worst part about all this is, and I'll admit, I have not watched the entire Britney Spears documentary, but they also seem a little bit horny for her to have a Mariah Carey like emotional breakdown. You know what I mean?
Sure.
It's like, that's part of it. Part of it was wanting to watch her fail. That was the whole,
I don't know. I feel like the latest news cycle is this thing where we're all beating ourselves up for, like, you know, supposedly wanting her to fail. But like, really that was kind of just like a backlash at the kind of like machine of celebrity. And so now it's like we're going back to the people who like ran that machine, and they're like, man, wasn't the media terrible? And it's like,
guys, it's very annoying to watch the media do the exact same thing and pretend to not be culpable.
Well, also then they're like interviewing all of her like managers and stuff, and they're like talking about these horrible interviews that she did, and it was like, didn't you like schedule that interview? Like, weren't you sitting in the next room while all that shit was going down? Like,
weren't you hand wringing and drooling as she was crying?
Yeah, like you did that on purpose. Don't act like it was an accident.
Yeah, it's not a good sign they already had a reference point for the type of meltdown referring to another pop star.
Yeah. I mean, that was what was most interesting to me, is that they were using someone besides Britney Spears to describe, like, that kind of breakdown.
Right, because once 07 hits, then it becomes a Britney Spears-style meltdown. She subsumed the... definitely a lot of blame to go around. Most of it should be levied towards... the people who are, you know, responsible for her, and also, just the media writ large. I think it's, I will say that, not that they're the biggest players in this, but there was that one paparazzi guy in the in the documentary who just like, well, I thought she was kind of kidding or whatever. It's like, okay, dude, like, maybe you shouldn't have taken this interview. Like, what was the...
Yeah.
Come on, man. You know?
Well, it's weird that I think then and now everybody's kind of like, wait, that's legal? It's legal to just like hang out around somebody's house and like take pictures of it. And then we all have to act like it's a, if you just don't look at the pictures or buy the magazines, like, you wouldn't support those people. And,
exactly,
and
we're kind of just like, vote with your dollar.
Couldn't we just have like a law that said, you know, people are entitled to privacy and whatnot?
No, that. We want to watch them burn.
We learned our lesson from that movie with Cole Hauser, where he murders Tom Sizemore and one of the older Baldwins. I think it's just called Paparazzi.
Yeah.
Wait, is that the one that Adrian Grenier made?
Ooh, It might be. I don't know. I know he had a real problem because he was trying to live in the moment. I'm trying to think of when that came. When did that come out?
I know. Adrian Grenier produced some sort of paparazzi movie at some point about how bad they were. Yeah.
I mean, it was just like, yeah, they found like some of the greasiest guys they could find kind of going. And no, that was a Mel Gibson production, I think. But it was 2004, so it was before Mel Gibson. We found out why he really hated the press, I guess.
The press.
Another thing that was happening, this was actually smack dab in the middle of the DC sniper case.
And, right.
Yeah, so this was also from the New York Times. Test length 7th victim to gun used in sniper spree. So, yeah, he's killed 7 people now. And they don't know why.
Okay, so that seals it for me. I was trying to figure out which year of college this was. not this episode, but like just generally. And yeah, so during this time, I had my appendix out like at some point before this or around this, maybe right around when this episode came out. So I was like laid up for a while, but I was in DC. So my parents were like coming down to protect me from the sniper and also visit me at the hospital. Strange time. Kind of a weird thing that, you know, we just kind of were like, yeah, well, that happened. Oh, all right. They're in jail, you know.
Yeah, some random guy might just shoot you while you're getting gas.
Would you say, what a time to be alive? I'm sorry.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
I guess that's true.
If you exit the Zoom, I will understand completely.
That counts as a plug. I'll take it. That's usually way better than I am at it. So that's good enough.
In lighter news, this is from the Post. You know, it's not quite something that we would remember, but I think it really says a lot about where we were at as a culture in 2002. Headline, Naked Twins 5-Year Plan. And then the Jesus. Article, and this is, I'll just
wait,
read.
Naked, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'll read the entirety of the article. Lane and Kyle Carlson, the twins who typically show up wearing their birthday suits in the Abercrombie & Fitch catalog, have started dabbling in real estate. The Cutie Pie brothers have formed a real estate investment company called DoubleTake and plan to own at least 5 rental properties within 5 years, according to the Minneapolis Star Tribune.
Okay, how old are these people? Like, what are we talking babies here?
We're getting to that. The 23-year-olds have business degrees from Winona State University, and we hope they've learned the lesson that real estate requires keeping the rents coming in and not the clothes coming off.
What the fuck? That famous lesson that we all know. I'm sure if they did that just a few years later, they were probably in great shape to weather the crisis in 2008.
Yeah.
With their real estate bona fides.
I know that like if you had a financial advisor in like 2007, he was saying, look, just get a mortgage, just get a few of them going, get those properties to work for you.
Yeah. The housing bubble will never burst.
To keep your clothes on, keep the rents coming in.
That's what he'd be saying. That's right.
And wear clean underwear.
It's funny because, because nowadays it'd be like, no, I would just keep the clothes coming off. Just start an OnlyFans. He'll make way more money.
Yeah. I mean, like those guys, I'm trying to think of what, like the idea that was even in the Post, like is weird to me. Like, that's like such a sub level of celebrity, even for like a guy. That must have been a really slow news day, I guess, in the
Which is weird because it's like, you know, the Afghanistan war is happening and the ramp up to the Iraq war is happening. And they're like, what's going on with these naked fuck boys?
Well, this is page 6 though. Right, so like that, you know, they don't concern themselves unless they just vaguely Cindy Adams says she's pro the war or something. That's about all you get in the gossip area. But like, those guys would just be Vine guys or I guess TikTok guys now.
Yeah,
right?
They'd be doing TikTok guys,
Abercrombie modeling or whatever. You just go straight to the, you know,
straight to the.
I've never understood sexualizing twins. Just what does two of them have to do with it? It doesn't make it double sexy. It makes it weirder. There's incest involved.
A twin, so you have a weird perspective on this.
That's true, but I have a twin sister, and if we were both naked on the, you know, selling Abercrombie and Fitch shit, you know, I think people would be they'd be weirded out, and rightfully so. Whereas, like, you know, if it's two hot chicks who are twins, everyone's like, oh, that's sick. Maybe they'll kiss. And it's like, why? Why do you want them to kiss?
They end up in a beer commercial.
Yeah, literally. Right. Yeah, people are like, in the 90s, people really wanted to see twins fuck. All right, let's move on.
another big stuff happening. The top movies in the country at this point were, you know, a big favorite of Matt Lieb. Red Dragon was the number
one. Oh, hell yeah. You are privy to a great becoming.
Mm-hmm. Hell yeah. Mandy is a fool.
Mandy is a fool. Ride with me.
Number 10. And then holdovers from last week. There's Sweet Home Alabama and The Tuxedo.
Sick.
Top pop song, A Moment Like This by Kelly Clarkson. Mm-hmm.
I want to clarify my ook from before. It's not Kelly Clarkson generally. I actually think she has a lot of really great songs. That was just like the American Idol snooze. Like, she just won, I guess, right?
So yeah.
Yeah, that's just not that song's not for me. I love, I even like Breakaway, which is definitely the same kind of corny ballad, but I just don't like A Moment Like This.
She's probably the best of the American Idols, right?
You're forgetting Taylor Hicks.
Sure.
Yeah, I was just gonna, yes, yeah. I think definitely.
Yeah.
Taylor Hicks was great because everyone said, oh, fuck it. Give it to the old ugly guy.
Well, that's right. It just became like an exercise in, let's see if we can get this weird act to win. And then it's like not marketable at all.
Like, yeah. They're like,
wasn't there like a Rick Astley type, like, who sang all Sinatra songs? And it's like, nobody's going to buy these records. Like, who, like, I'm sure Simon, I mean, obviously they have everybody under their thumb, you know, that's on the show.
Right.
Like, if you go on the show, you're indebted to them or whatever, I'm sure. And you sign a contract. But like, yeah, the person they want to push is not the, 17-year-old redhead crooner, or, you know, whatever. No, he's not really going to do it.
What about Sanjaya? Just...
What happened?
That was a bit, right? That was like Howard Stern was driving that one or something?
Yeah.
Right?
Sanjaya was just someone who was terrible.
He was like kind of bad. And I only remember it because I remember like there was this really like New York-y comedian that I would see at open mics in San Francisco, and he would always talk about Sanjaya. Like, I'm fucking pulling for this kid, you know, like this fucking Sanjaya. I think it's real funny. I don't know why he was like this really bro-y New York guy that would only talk about Sanjaya.
Well, you know, a lot of mental illness in stand-up. Yeah, that's just part
so,
of it.
So true. Top rock song was Never Again by Nickelback.
Hell yeah. Good shit.
Sure. I don't think I've ever even heard that song.
Yeah,
I don't know it.
Like, I the only Nickelback song that I think I can think of off the top of my head is the This Is How You Remind Me one.
Sure.
Everything mm-hmm. else kind of just blends into one.
No, I mean they have, you know, Someday, Photograph. I'm not a big, like, I think making fun of Nickelback as like a stand-in for like, you know, bad music is a very hack thing
very
in general.
Hack.
But
yeah.
Like, I literally don't, because I know the album that How You Remind Me is on came out on 9/11. I know that was one of the albums that came out on that day. So this is a year later. I guess this is like a later album, you know, cut that was a single. And if it was number one in rock, maybe it was never really like a big hit on the main chart. But I literally have never heard it. I can imagine what the structure is like, though.
Here's a little bit of it.
They all sound like the same.
I could make an approximation. I could do a police sketch of the song. If you gave me an hour and a guitar with some fuzz on it, I would be like, it's probably this.
Oh, you guys can't hear my Spotify. Sorry.
Damn. No, well. Can't.
It was grooving.
Yeah, anyway. Well, it's fine. There's some snare in there. So, yeah, that's the Remember When machine.
All right. Well, let's get into this episode. So, you know, like Vince said, the general synopsis is Joke sparks a series of hit contracts. Carmella, you know, also wants to be with Furio, blah, blah, blah. Very boring. So I would like to present to you the Bada B stories. Bow, wow, wow, yippee-yay, yippee-yo. Here's the Bada B story, Sopranos 404. Piss on my face, would you, Johnny? AJ visits Furio's house with his mommy. And here's a Ginny joke about your wifey that you might not get. I'll make you go repeat that shit. Zach's bark was loud, but his bite wasn't vicious. Genie's eating candy while pretending to eat nutritious. Chrissy gets with the Atwell Avenue boys like, is he crazy? But they blind and old as fuck, so maybe. Boom. I did it. I wish I had rap background to it. That's what it's called, rap background.
Yeah. So, I mean, mm-hmm. I thought last episode was like a very special episode, but this one very much feels like a very special episode of The Sopranos. And I don't know. Of this season, I think this is the weak link by far, personally.
Oh, yes. Yes. Let's.
And I think there's a very, like, the.
Get into it.
I think the specific reason for that is, like, the reason I like The Sopranos is that they generally make every character seem terrible. And yet, like, this one, like, the main storylines is like how loving of a wife or how loving of a husband Johnny Sack is. It feels like the when you're in a job interview and they ask you to, you know, criticize yourself or say something like your biggest fault, and you're like, oh, I just care too much. Like,
this is
Johnny Sack being like, I just care too much about my wife. That's why I went a little crazy.
He's a wife guy. He's you know, he's like the original wife guy.
Yeah, he's the first. I love my fat dropped. Wife guy for sure. Like that is his, you know, he is, yeah, proto that meme.
Yeah, I don't think that guy who was like a social media consultant or whatever, I don't think he was ever going to murder anybody over somebody criticizing his wife. So,
Yeah.
I think he's top of the heap on that.
Yeah, so yeah. I got a clip of, you know, the sort of inciting event of this episode. If we want to take a listen, you know, the big scene at the beginning.
Let's do it.
I think, is this like how many episodes have started with someone attacking someone else? Like the guy that, yeah, what's his name? April. Didn't he, when he paralyzed,
oh, yeah,
the guy?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Richie April did attack Beansy. I think that was the opening of that episode in season two. So yeah, it's another kind of like opening where you just see some random mob violence happening.
Then the Mustang guy who, like,
Mustang Sally
hit the guy, mm-hmm, with the crowbar. I like when he started an episode with some random person getting maimed.
Yeah, you know, in screenwriting class, they call that the inciting event on page 3. Mm. I don't know if you guys ever know about screenwriting, but
I should. I was like a film major and somehow, yeah, no, I never covered that one. I
took an online class once, I know a little bit.
Was that you studying with Robert McKee?
I don't know who that
is. He's the guy, the script guru from Adaptation, who is a real guy, but, you know.
Oh, really?
Yeah, when Charlie Kaufman is struggling adapting The Orchid Thief and he goes to the screenwriting seminar and he's like, what if I write a story where nothing much happens, like life? And then Robert McKee's like, nothing happens in life! Every day! A nun gets murdered on the steps of a church. You know, that whole speech, you remember?
I don't, but right, that sounds, well, good too.
Here's the attack.
I think that might have come, that, I mean, based on the timing of when Adaptation came out, that might have been the next thing that Brian Cox did after Super Troopers. It's not impossible.
Yeah. Two great roles.
Hey. Donnie, right?
John, how you doing?
What's the matter? Not funny anymore?
Bitch, John!
John, what the fuck? What'd he do?
He's a cunt. Sorry, sack of shit.
Come on, let me get you out of here. Come on, come on.
No, no.
Please. Scumbag? Let me buy you a drink.
Just pissing on his face.
I mean, let me buy you a drink is, yeah,
that's a good line.
That's up there. Yeah,
it's very
especially
good.
When you're, especially when you're presumably seeing red, like Ferdinand the Bull, like, which, you know, you have to assume he is at that point. That's impressive.
That's yeah, that was actually his gangster name, was, you know, Ferdinand the Bull Sacrimony.
Mm-hmm. I think I'm misremembering Ferdinand, by the way. I think the whole thing with Ferdinand is that he doesn't get mad. Is that right? I think that might be.
I never saw that one.
I'd like to apologize to all the Ferdinand fans out there.
All the Ferdistans.
Yeah.
It's interesting, like, this opening, too.
You really get the Foley artist having fun again there. Like, that whole scene, again, I just think about all ADR. The sound guys, just how much, mm-hmm, fun they were having putting that together.
Yeah, just knocking, you know, hitting hams with crowbars and shit like that, just trying to get that perfect punch sound. I enjoy this opening. Well, first of all, let me just go more general here. I completely agree with you that this episode is probably the weakest link of the season so far, which, you know, apologies to Patrick for having you on an episode that I personally almost forgot most of it. It's because I've rewatched The Sopranos, you know, maybe 3-4 times or something like that. And this had a lot of story that I kind of forgot. Like, I remembered certain aspects of it, you know, Jeannie and the joke and like all of the drama that it caused. But in terms of just basically what happens in this episode, I was like, this is bad. It's
well, because it ends with everything turning out okay.
Right. It ends with everything turning out okay. It's a lot of tension, no release. And for the most part, it's like, it's kind of just an episode about how when you hear a joke out of context, it ruins the joke and it turns it offensive. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like it's
Joe Sinclitico's dad, our friend of the show, his dad's like a lawyer, and he would always tell Joe, who's a comedian, he's like, you know, there's nothing less funny than a joke being read out in court. So whatever you can do to avoid that in life.
Yeah. And it's about how, you know, jokes are hurtful, kind of. It's also about, you know, I guess like weight double standards between men and women, you know, because like Jenny is like ridiculed for her weight while Tony continues to like stuff his fat fucking face this whole episode. And it's about, you know, like Carm kind of just wanting to fuck Furio. And
it's always an impressive, I don't know if impressive is the right word, but whenever I see an episode like this, I think about the writer like choosing to write this for an actress. And then I think about what the conversation with the actress is going to be like, where the whole thing revolves around like people making fun of her weight and it being like a thing.
I know. I thought about that too. I was like, God, this is like, I understand it's part of the job and she's probably used to it, but that still sucks.
Well, here's the thing. Okay. She was not an actress. She,
oh, right.
She answered. She answered an open casting call in Harrison, New Jersey in 2000, mm-hmm. had no previous acting experience.
And they were like, you're just round enough to play a mob wife.
I remember David Chase telling me about it at the Christmas party, Barino Quinn told the Home News Tribune. He said he wrote a whole episode about me and that I had a lot of work to do.
A lot of work to do.
Jeez, that's like a monkey's paw situation.
Yeah.
And this is going to revolve around you. It's going to revolve around, you know, well, don't worry about it. It's fine. Yeah, yeah. The thing is that you're nice. Everyone's talking about how, you know, like it's, yeah. Your husband loves you.
I think, right. I think the work that she had to do was shaving off her eyebrows and painting them on 3 inches higher.
Yeah, no, that takes a lot of work.
No, actually came from her obituary because,
what? No.
Yeah. She got married in 2005. Good for her. She got stomach stapling in 2007 and lost 175 pounds.
Shit.
And then she died of liver cancer 7 months after her husband also died of liver cancer in 2010.
What? God. Yeah. They both got liver cancer?
Yep.
Isn't that a rare cancer?
I don't know. I don't think it's that rare.
I think it is.
I think it's probably statistically unusual that a couple would both have it. I think that's probably.
That's sure. Very strange.
Unless they met in like, you know, like a liver support group of some kind.
Yeah, that's true too. Like yeah, that is possible.
Like the basement of Fight Club situation kind of thing.
Yeah, all the love that comes out of meeting at someone at Fight Club.
No, you know how he goes to the support groups for all the cancer.
No, I get it.
Yeah, all right. I was just trying to do a thing where I had to explain a joke because that's the theme of this episode. Because
that's the theme of this episode. Yeah. It's explaining a joke. So that opening scene is pretty good because of the there's no real indication that Donnie and his friend are laughing specifically about Johnny Sack's, you know, rotund wife, but he just assumes they are because they are laughing.
Well, it's also an illustration of shit rolling downhill. Like he knows that Ralphie's a made guy and a capo and he can't do anything to him, but some random guy that's part of Ralphie's crew, like that guy, you can kick the shit out of and no one can say anything about.
And he's not even part of Ralphie's crew. Didn't it turn out that he's not? He just assumed he was because he was laughing.
No, he worked for Ralphie.
He did work for Ralphie.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Yeah, it's pretty great. The next scene is that Johnny Sack comes home covered in blood on his Burberry jacket and his fists, and Jeannie meets him downstairs and goes, "Oh my God, you're bleeding." And he goes, "I fell," which is an obvious lie, maybe the most obvious lie. And then as soon as she's like, "You're bleeding from your hand," he's like, "I was breaking my fall. What's going on with you asking me about this stuff?" But part of me is like, you know, if you really loved her, you would tell her, "Oh, I beat the shit out of someone for you."
Babe. Right.
You know?
Yeah. I feel like this is the interesting thing about this scene. And they do it a few times in The Sopranos. And I feel like this is kind of one of the, you know, I love the show, but I feel like this is kind of a fault of the show where they kind of make the bosses seem like tougher than they are. Because you look at Johnny Sack and you're like, that guy's not kicking the shit out of anybody. And I think, I assume the idea was that like someone who's not a made guy would be afraid to like hit a made guy back. And so,
right.
But I don't know that they make that clear enough in the show. And you see it with Tony other times too, where he's like beating up these like younger, like big dudes. I don't know. It always rings a little false to me.
I mean, yeah, you just have to assume that they know that the person is made and is high up and outranks them. And that they, because of that, they're just like, I'm just going to allow myself to get beat up. But I just don't see that as like, I don't know. It doesn't ring true to me because I feel like most of these Guidos be like, you know, kicked a couple of times and then be like, okay, and then throw him halfway across the room because right. he's like a fucking old man who smokes. Like, yeah. there's no way he could.
Gandolfini is like a house, though. Like,
yeah,
like,
no, Gandolfini like, makes a little bit more sense.
He's a huge guy.
Yeah.
He's out of shape. He probably couldn't run after you if you tried to run away for very long. But, like, yeah, I don't know how tall. It's Vincent Curatola, right? Is Johnny Sack? Is that the right name?
Yeah. That's right.
I don't know if he's a tall guy or not, but yeah, I mean, he certainly has puffed up since those days too. He's a judge on The Good Wife, which we're watching.
Oh, wow. He's built like a bowling pin and he's got the hair that looks like the back of a duck. And he wears the jackets where he doesn't, or he wears like the pullovers where he doesn't put his sleeves or he doesn't put his arms through the sleeves. And like all of those three things combined make me think like this guy's not throwing any punches by him on his own.
Yeah, I mean, you know, again, you have to suspend a little bit of disbelief, but it's fair enough. I'm like, okay, I believe that someone wouldn't fight back to the point of being hospitalized. I don't know about all that.
I feel like they could make that a little clearer in those scenes is all.
For sure. So then next we get into, I think, Carmen Furio's story. Well, first it's Carm is getting investment advice from her cousin Brian, and Tony being completely uninterested in what's going on there. And you know, I gotta mirror Tony's reaction.
Yeah, same.
Completely uninterested.
Yeah.
And it sucks because like I feel for Carm, like this season especially, you really get to see Edie Falco become like far and away the best actress, the best actor on The Sopranos. Like she's really fantastic. But as per her character, I'm not interested in her money worries either.
That's such like a classic husband thing. Cause you know, like I just got married this past year and you do like get in situations where you end up having to like talk about finances. And yeah, I'm kind of with Tony. Like I can't imagine anything more fucking boring than like talking about like trusts and life insurance and shit. Like it just, every time, I know yeah, it's things you have to do, but it makes me want to blow my brains out as well. So I get it.
I mean, the guy's framing it the wrong way, right? I mean, he probably doesn't really, he's not officially aware of what, maybe he's not read into the mob thing. You know, it's not clear always who knows exactly what's going on or who's, it's comfortable talking about what's going on. But like the way to pitch a mob guy on stuff like that is, here's where you put your money so no one can take it away. Here's where you put your money, so you know, stuff like that. Yeah. You give it over to your wife, you know, although that's not a good idea, obviously, with Tony and Carmella. But like, you know, like, and this way, you have, even if the feds come, they can't, you know, seize it or, you know, that kind of, that, you know, and that's, but this guy's clearly just like a young goon who just got out of college or whatever. That actor, by the way, also on The Good Wife. Just want to point that out.
Oh, man.
Oh, man.
It's a Good Wife of Palooza this episode.
Yeah,
a lot of Soprano, I feel like the veterans on The Good Wife. I need to check out this Good Wife show.
He's only in a couple episodes. He's a highway cop who arrests Juliana Margulies' son for pot possession, and then he has to, yeah. So that's his arc.
Sorry, can I stop for 1 second? I gotta go yell up and bring my dogs inside because they're driving me fucking crazy. Sorry,
okay.
1 second.
Podcast.
So yeah, like I was curious about both of your general thoughts on this Carmella Furio love angle here.
I mean, I think it's the thing about Sopranos that I really enjoy, which is like kind of bringing in the, it's a mixture of the mafia life and the suburban life. And this is very much like both meeting at the exact same time, you know, it's like, it's a very suburban thing to just be in love with a random hot like younger Italian man. Uh-huh. You know, it's like it's almost soap opera-ish. And like it could be a subplot of Days of Our Lives or a subplot of Big Little Lies. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I enjoy it. I especially enjoy the sexual tension of it because it just reads as so real. Because fucking, again, Edie Falco is just an incredibly gifted actor, so like you really feel how fucking thirsty she is, you know. So I'm a big fan of watching it kind of like grow. It's
I think when I first watched this, especially, I mean, I haven't done like a full rewatch or anything, and obviously I matured as the show went on, so but you know, but like I definitely was somebody who would be like, "This is supposed to be a gangster show. Come on, like, what is this? You know, that kind of thing." You know, like we're like not like where's Tony at all times, but kind of where's Tony at all times. You know, where's at least one of the guys from the, you know, and like also just like making, you know, Furio like not do like beat people up or whatever was not right. Like my, you know, but like watching it now and even watching this, like, I mean, this is a later scene, but like that story he tells about working in the Olive, you know, place, yeah. Like, it's beautiful. And it's like, and the acting is so good that like you see like in Carmela that she's like knocked over, you know, that she like
completely
wishes that Tony had that kind of depth about anything, you know what I mean? Or at least shared it if he had it. And that, you know, like just that, like, I don't know. There's something that's very, I come to appreciate a lot differently. When I wasn't somebody who was, you know, eating 8,000 calories a week and drinking 4,000 calories a week in college or whatever, you know, and just being a complete moron for 4 years.
I got I got a clip of that.
One time, back in Naples, I work in the garden as a landscaper for a very rich man. Just me, I work there alone, growing olives. My hands in the dirt, the hot sun. I was never so happy in my life as when I work at that place. Sometimes I get the smell of olives in a restaurant, in a store maybe. It makes me very sad.
I love this plot line for Carmela, but I don't know. I feel like there's part of me that I am still like the dumb guy. It's not that I want Furio to beat people up, but I think what I've always enjoyed about Furio is that he is like the contrast, where he is like this earthy, like sensitive guy who wants to like dance with the women, and then but then like I always like when he just turns on a dime, where he like he's very thoughtful, and then like mm-hmm. in last episode, you know, he's thoughtful like, oh no, isn't Columbus the hero of America? And then he's like, but you know, being from Naples, we hate it. You know, he immediately like goes hard, like he snaps, and that's. I feel like that's such a great thing about him. And like this episode, like you don't get like the part of Furio where he's very excitable. Like he kind of
right.
Like
you don't see the sociopath in this. You just kind of see.
You just see the idealized like Italian lover in this.
Right. There's the romantic idealized Italian lover. But part of me also goes like, he knows what the fuck he's doing, right?
Sure,
like he's kind of on some fuckboy shit where he knows, because he likes Carmela, I think, just as much as Carmela likes him.
Oh, definitely.
So I don't know. I feel like he's telling the story about like, I work with my hands in the garden. Like he's like, you know, he's trying to, you know, get that pussy wet. And I feel like that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. I just like, maybe it's my need to ascribe like some sort of like sociopathic.
Well, again, it's the thing it's the thing I said about this entire episode, which is that, you know, a lot of these characters don't come off looking venal and shitty like they do in every other episode. Like you could leave this episode thinking like, oh, Johnny Sack's a really good guy. Oh, right. Silvio's a really good guy. Like, oh,
yeah.
You know, even Tony comes off looking pretty good in this episode, which is, you know, odd.
The thing about Furio that I think is great is that he's like, all these guys in Jersey, especially like in New York, but in Jersey, like this like reflection of what the mafia is in New Jersey is like, you know, a bunch of guys driving around in Cadillacs or whatever, you know, like in Naples, like these are terrifying people.
Right. Exactly.
He's like the real guy, you know, what I mean? And they bring him over and like, he's like a huge asset for like what you know, in terms of that kind of thing. But like, they look at him at the party and he's dancing like, look at this, what a, you know, come on. And it's like, no, this is like the scariest person you've ever met in your life.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. And he's got like this just because he has more than one side to him, because he has a little bit more of, he's not just like a, you know, Goomba guy from, you know, from Jersey. Like I think it's a fascinating thing about him. And also like the shirts are just outrageous. Like,
yeah. Oh yeah.
But he's killing it.
But I think you hit the nail.
It looks like the Rock.
It looks like
from
the,
that era.
It looks like the, you know, the ceiling of a fucking Italian church or something. But yeah, like I think you hit the nail on the head with why I like Furio, is which is like, you know, on the one hand, he's like this old world guy who's sensitive in these ways, but he's also like, yeah, a stone cold, like he's definitely the most psychotic killer out of all of these people, and I think that's mm-hmm. what makes him such a great character. But yeah, in this episode you really only see like the one facet of Furio.
Hey there, did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Yeah, and the purpose that it serves is purely just for Carm's sake. It's not really for Furio's sake so much, you know, like, because you, the viewer, know his darker side. So rather than having you, they don't need to remind you that sure. he's like a fucking stone cold killer. Mm-hmm. I understand, like, looking at it and being like, oh, what happened to when he used to punch, you know, fucking old ladies in the face just to get money, you know? But
I like the small reminders that everyone's a piece of shit, which The Sopranos usually does not go an entire episode without reminding you. But I feel like this is one of their rare episodes where they don't really remind you how big a piece of shit everyone is. I mean, it's there, but
yeah. Yeah.
You're metaphorically AJ in that scene.
Yeah, yeah, you are. Yeah. I'm so bored I could cry. So this is the most relatable thing. There's a few things in The Sopranos that are like that, where they describe what feeling they're having and how close it is to bringing them to tears. You know, I think Tony at one point is like, said, I'm so depressed I can't even think straight, you know, I'm so bored I could cry. I'm like, yeah, I've felt all of these things before. So Carm brings over AJ to Furio's place when she wants to show him some detail about like zoning law, some boring shit. I mean, it's just an excuse to go over there, but brings AJ along, I think, and I'm trying to just, you know, probe you guys about why you think AJ was brought along.
She brought him there to keep up appearances. Like, she knew it would be weird if she went over to Furio's house alone. But, yeah, you know, she brought AJ so that it looked like a work call, you know?
It just seems like you're inviting disaster. And, you know, whether or not this disaster, like, comes to fruition, it doesn't really, you know, it doesn't materialize, but like part of me was like, you know, AJ is a fucking blabbermouth, right? Like this right. idiot, like as soon as like, oh, we were just in the neighborhood, he's like, no, we weren't. It's like, fucking this dude is not good at like if you're trying to have a side piece, like I would not invite AJ along. That's all I'm
right.
saying.
It's not, and it's not even that he's trying to mess with her. He's just like, oh, she's wrong. I have to say she's wrong. Like he's just a little pain in the ass. Like it's not even like he's trying to stir anything up. It's just
born twat blocker.
He is. He's just trying to twat block, and I don't even think he knows that yet because he's still kind of stupid.
He doesn't know at all. He doesn't care. No.
Yeah, he's just really, really mad that he has to go, that he had a responsibility to like hang out with his mom for a second. So the Furio and Carmela stuff kind of wraps up with like they're dancing at his housewarming party, that music is playing, just Italian music.
The thing that struck me with that music was, you know, it was. I said this to Whitney, my girlfriend at the time. It was like, it's so Italian that it like almost is like Middle Eastern. It's like confusing.
Right. Yes.
Well, it's like way out there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like from a like, it's not what you think of, because again, it's Italy Italian and not like, you know, when you hear
not Italian like, oh, American,
like a mob party. You
yeah,
know,
they're not
like,
talking about, you know, moons hitting eyes well, or also, pies. What is this shit?
He's Sicilian. So like Sicily is, right. you know, right. culturally like as much North African as it is, you know, Northern European. Like it's pretty,
yeah,
it's pretty close. Yeah. Like there's a lot of, but yeah, it is the exact kind of thing where you'd listen to it and all these Italian Americans would be like, oh shit, is that what like yeah, this is this sounds like, so
what
foreign.
Is this garbage yeah. and it's like it's actual Italian music and they're like, I don't like it, but
yeah,
put on some Bing Crosby. Is Bing Crosby Italian? I don't know why I added that.
I don't know.
I'll just say Dean Martin then.
It used to end in an I and he changed it,
but yeah, so the episode ends with the Carm storyline, and it is it's a strange ending. And this is just to end her storyline, not to end the rest of the podcast. But
the final episode of the podcast.
This the is final episode of the podcast. We're done after this because we hated it so much. No, it ends with, you know, Carm is surprised by a gift from Saks Fifth Avenue that Tony gets her, and they try it on, and it's all just a means to fuck her, which, enough.
By the way, like, by far the most uncomfortable scenes to me in all of The Sopranos is when Tony and Carmela are actually, like, enjoying each other and having sex. I hate,
yes,
I hate watching them have sex. It's gross.
Yeah, it is. It's kind of like watching your parents have sex,
yeah,
which I think is like, I think it's part of it. I think that's, you know, it's supposed to, I think it's because we just, as you know, media consumers are not used to seeing two middle-aged people fuck, and so when we watch it we're like, oh, they're not supposed to do
well,
that.
I think it's also because it's so, they're so clearly going through the motions, like it's not it's not like a hot lust fuck. It's like these people have been together for 30 years and they're really just like going through the motions to pretend that there's still mm-hmm. something there.
Right. But what's strange is it ends with a false ending. That's a bit. And the bit is you hear the same Italian, you know, song that played at the party. It fades in as they begin having sex. And you kind of think, okay, this is the ending. You know, Sopranos ends with music and then they fade out. And then she's like, stop, I can't. And then they tell Meadow to turn down the music because it turns out it is music that's within the reality of the show, which is like a kind of a funny bit, but I'm not really sure what the point of it was.
The
especially
point, the point is both of those kids are cock blockers.
That's true. The kids in general are cock blocking, but like, especially given the fact that as soon as they turn the music down, and they start having sex, then the show plays music and it's more of that, like, you know, ethnically Southern Italian music again. And they're playing a song, Vesuvio, which a little trivia there. it just, to me, like, I don't know, man, the whole episode, just threw me off a little bit. It was, it just felt, I don't know, stitched together from scraps of,
yeah, there's
better,
like,
episodes.
There's a lot of weird storylines, and some of them are more effective than others. I did enjoy, it's sort of halfway done, but I enjoyed the weird Meadow storyline with the law center.
Yes.
I have a clip of it, and just like the first line of her describing the law center, like, almost made me spit out my drink, so I gotta give them credit for that one.
Of course, some people will tell you college only serves to show grad schools who managed to show up somewhere 4 years in a row, but...
So first of all, like, oh man, just talk about like the most insufferable college thing that you could ever say to a person. Like, oh yeah, this is all just like an audition for grad school, you know, am I right?
Volunteering at the law center actually allows you to make a difference. Last year, with our help, over half a dozen crack babies reunited with their natural mothers, several of whom are now in recovery. Eventually, with the help of ACLU attorneys, you'll be filing court papers and helping with legal research. There's a sign-up sheet and some flyers if you're interested. Thanks.
That is like the perfect college person charity work where they like you're still insulting the people that you do charity
right.
work.
They're still crack babies, yeah. But it's like, well, I'm not gonna ditch the imagery of crack baby, just so you know. Like, yeah. It's clearly a euphemism for, I mean, you know, they were all crack babies. It's like, no, you know what I mean. Like, indigent black babies.
Yeah,
like,
it's like
what she was saying, but she was just like, you know, crack babies.
It's like one of those phrases that you're like, theoretically it's not offensive, but then you hear it and you're like, oh, did you just say that with the hard C? Ooh,
yeah,
like,
there is. I had the same reaction where it's just, I just hadn't heard the phrase crack baby in so long, yeah. That as soon as she said it, I was like, ow, why would you say that?
You know what it reminded me of? The other day I was, you know, I was at the coffee shop and there's like this outdoor area where I, you know, do my stupid blogging bullshit. Uh-huh. And these cops were sitting down next to me, kind of near enough to me where I could hear their conversation. And they're doing the cop thing where they refer to everything as like a vehicle and they're like constantly using big words to
right. Yeah, that ascertain. Cop thing.
Yeah.
I would like to ascertain one cup of coffee, please.
Yeah. I'm going to get out of my vehicle and I need to ascertain a cup of coffee. And, but in the midst of that, I heard the guy use the word.
Not, it's like, guys, you're not lying to a judge to get a warrant. Okay.
Yeah. Right. They're talking to each other. And it was like, I know that's so drilled into you, but it makes you sound not only really dumb, but also super full of shit. So like, maybe mm-hmm. you don't want to do that anymore. Yeah. Anyway, so, but in the midst of that, I heard the guy use the word tweaker like six times, which yeah. is really funny to me because he's like being all clinical and he's like, you know, I got out of the vehicle to ascertain what was happening with the perpetrators. And obviously one of them was a tweaker. So blah, blah, blah. Like, the same. So
that's
throwback.
Offensive to all tweaker Americans.
Yeah, but it's the same kind of word as like crack baby. Where that's yeah. the only, that's the kind of word that you really only hear like a cop say.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so this is it's a interesting storyline. I feel like I did want more of both Meadow's storyline, and I was interested in what is it? Saskia?
Yeah. Saskia Kupferberg.
Yeah, so Saskia happens to be Elliot, which is Melfi's therapist's daughter.
I like Saskia, but I feel like in order to introduce Saskia, that we needed this whole Elliot sub plot line. And
yeah,
for one thing, like it, I don't care. And for another, like it didn't make a ton of sense to me.
Yeah, or a difference to the story. I mean, yeah. Honestly, the Melfi storyline in this is baffling. Right. I have no idea why it exists. So Melfi is complaining to Elliot that her son Jason is just kind of losing it in his last semester at college and, you know, is thinking about dropping out. And then they bring up Saskia, you know, is your daughter seems to be having, you know, doing fine and whatnot. And then we find out that this woman who is at the head of the law center or trying to recruit for it is Saskia. And you're like, oh, OK, so this is there's a connection there. But the entire storyline about Jason, I could give a shit about fucking Jason. What is the point of that story?
Well, it leads into the weird parking garage scene between Elliot and Tony, which doesn't, it's kind of just a head scratcher to me.
It's just another postmortem on the sexual assault episode from last season, which,
and the button is, you know, anything can happen in a parking garage. Is that what the fucking, what the fuck
honestly,
was that?
I don't know. I couldn't tell you why it existed. Any ideas, Patrick?
I thought it was nice, like, to show how out of touch that Elliot was, where he's like, he's probably like a tradesman of some kind or whatever.
It's oh,
like,
that was great.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like I thought that was pretty good. That obviously was not the main thrust of it, but just like, you start to realize, like, I mean, I don't know. I don't remember it that well, but I remember not thinking that this guy really added too much to her, like, as a therapist. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, he doesn't really seem like he's really, you know, because she's kind of already analyzing herself out loud a little bit, and he just kind of like chimes in, and it's like, what are you paying this guy? I mean, I guess you believe in therapy as a thing if you're a therapist, obviously, you know, it's kind of your whole deal, but like, yeah, he doesn't seem like he's adding a whole lot.
No, he doesn't add much to it at all. I mean, usually his role in whatever episode he's in, is mostly to kind of get Melfi's reaction to kind of the thing she's witnessing with Tony and in her own life. And it's like, it's sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad, but this was like, this just seemed like a random postmortem on the sexual assault thing, which
he also uses this word during therapy. Kanahora.
Yeah.
What the fuck is that?
I don't actually know. I heard, as soon as he said it, I was like, oh, it's Yiddish, but,
is that like knock on wood or
that's kind of in the context that he said it, that's kind of what I assumed it was.
It appears that way. Yeah. It looks like it means no evil eye. Just Googling it quickly.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah. It's something that I actually hadn't heard before, but you know when you hear
Yiddish has Yiddish? Evil eye too?
Oh, all the cultures have evil eye. All
right.
The Jews have evil eye, the Italians have the Maloich.
Mm-hmm.
What do the Irish have in terms of evil eye?
Evil eye was new to me, so I don't know if we have a specific eye. It's probably something to do with it's going to be involving some kind of death or despair. Or
yeah, it's the eye on the potato that tells you if you got the potato blight.
Yeah.
How dare you, Vince? You can't just do. I'm sorry. I do that accent all the time. But I have to admit, like, I love the way that Sopranos does upper middle class and rich intellectuals and whatnot. So like, you wanted more Saskia.
They get in early on shitting on like the neoliberal managerial class, which I really appreciate.
Yeah, they were kind of like they were doing PMC critiques before it was cool for sure.
Yeah.
A great scene that does happen though is the scene between Meadow and I forget the name. Was it Rahima? The name of her, the person who she was going to help at the law office, who was speaking of Britney Spears, was telling a story about someone who was beaten with sticks because they had a picture of Britney Spears in their wallet. And then Tony comes in and introduces himself, whatnot. Rahima leaves and grills Meadow about her new choice to get into law, which was interesting to me because it's like, well, if this is your daughter, you know, whether or not she becomes a pediatrician or a lawyer, like who the fuck cares? Like,
right.
You don't want a lawyer in the family, but it was.
Well, I think he wants to make sure she's not in law enforcement. You know, he doesn't want her to be a lawyer that helps people. You know, yeah. Or anything like that. He wants to make, you know, if you're going to be a lawyer, I want you to be a lawyer who gets rich and ideally one who can help me, kind of, I think is probably.
Right.
Yeah.
That's why I was glad between Elliot seeing him in the garage and thinking he was like a plumber or something.
Some sort of Italian plumber or something.
Yeah.
He was a like, Mario brother.
Like I was worried as this episode went on that I wasn't going to get like the sort of like classic Tony stuff. And I was naive in thinking that because like we got, first of all, we already talked about it or you already talked about it. I didn't really chime in too much, but a symphony of the breathing in the sex scene at the end. We got all the breathing, like all of it,
which
is fantastic.
The greatest nostril actor of our times.
Just amazing. Just true alpha stuff. Just nose whistling, you know. Really powerful.
Very powerful.
And then the other thing that is in a trench coat, just blissfully walking around the dorm with a box of Krispy Kremes with eating one of them. Like he got her a dozen or whatever, and he's eating one. Like he's taking one before he gets
I had to wet his beak a little bit.
Which is just such a perfect image. And he's got that blissful smile on his face.
Yeah.
Just kind of wandering around like, oh, what do we got? How did he get in there? Like you can't just walk into college in New York City after 9/11. Like you can't
You need a key at least.
It's like, do you go here? It's like, well, what does it look like? You know what I mean? Like, but I just love that image. That was enough for me to justify because I'm very skeptical of on prestige drama type stuff. anything to do with the children because I just don't fucking care usually.
Right.
I just generally don't. Like, I you know, and that's my big swear, I guess. So sorry about that. But that's what I feel the strongest about, apparently, on this entire episode.
You can swear as much as you want.
Oh, okay. Just making sure.
This is an R-rated show. This is TVMA.
This is a prestige podcast. Yeah.
I generally... Like, it's got to be good for me to really give a shit at all about what's going on with the teenage kids or whatever, you know, like, so, you know, her getting into a new hobby or whatever, it's like, my eyes are rolling out of my head, but him walking in, I don't, you know, and like, you want a donut, you know, to then, you know, like, perfect.
Yeah. But at the same time, this episode's like asking us to care about Melfi's off screen son. And it's like, okay, that's
very like strange.
Three bridges too far.
But yeah, I do love that in his like kind of inquisition of Meadow's choice to get involved in the law center, he needs to point out like, hey, just whatever you do, don't be taken in by these his malapropism is indigenous types. I think he meant indigent. And he's like, you know, basically saying the thing about, you know, most of these poor people who ask for help from the law is that they're all bilking you, you know. And then she's like, you know, this isn't all about you. And he's like, this is all revenge for how I treated Noel, which he also, the fact that he gets Meadow's ex-boyfriend's name wrong was the cherry.
This is the guy that he referred to as a barbecue accessory, correct?
Yes.
Is the guy?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
The Hasidic homeboy.
Yeah, it was her black Jewish ex-boyfriend who he met and first things first did a bunch of racism to.
Yeah.
And is mad at Meadow for wanting to get into law to, I don't know, piss him off. I don't know how it could piss him off, but with Tony, you're like, yeah, I could see it. Tony is he's skeptical, but
this whole episode wraps up with, you know, the beef is Johnny Sack is pissed at Ralphie.
Yeah.
And he asks for a sit down and he demands satisfaction. And Carmine's like, hey, you got to get the fuck over it, or, you know, name an amount or get the fuck over it. And then, you know, Carmine basically tells Tony to whack Johnny Sack.
To whack Sack.
But he does it the coward's way, which is that you give the nod. As they say,
well, that's the mafia way, dude. No one ever says, "Hey, I'm going to need you to kill this man."
No, yeah, they do. They do that if they are, you know, okay with you doing it. Whereas, like,
not over the phone.
As Tony said, he wanted plausible deniability so that so nothing would ever come back on him, not from the cops, but just from his own New York crew,
right.
Just love to have that kind of trusting relationship with people in your business where it's like, oh, I didn't tell them to hang on. Whoa, what? Whoa, all right. You know,
that's the way I feel like all my bosses have treated me.
just constant ass covering.
Yeah.
It's true. It is. I love in movies and TV shows where like it's some fantastical thing, but then you get like the, you know, middle management like hassle, you know, as part of like in Rogue One with Mendelsohn, where he's like getting yelled at from two different angles, and then like Grand Moff Tarkin takes credit for the Death Star. It's like, come on, like that's just, it's like office shit, you know, which is funny in that context. It's kind of like that.
Oh, the mob's all corporate politics. That's what's great about it.
So
then you know, Johnny Sack decides that he loves his wife and doesn't care, and decides to call the whole thing off. Like mid,
well, yeah, it's this weird kind of anticlimax because, like, I had kind of forgotten that there was a storyline where there's simultaneous hits being called on both Ralphie by Johnny Sack and Johnny by Carmine. So it was confusing for me because it's like, oh yeah, that's right. This is a whole thing that's about to just peter out.
I did sort of enjoy the interlude of the inbred weird assassins in Rhode Island because I feel like I feel like gangster movies always sort of romanticize like the Murder Inc. Like the people in the mob whose thing was murdering people. They seem like they go out of their way to make those people look super cool. And The Sopranos was like, oh no, if like those guys are real, if your thing was like murdering people, that meant you were like a real fucking weird.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this is our first and I believe only time we get to meet the Atwell Avenue boys, who are the ones who are being hired to kill Johnny Sack when he heads up to Boston.
I got a little clip of that if you want to hear.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Good. It was a guy once, Tommy Neri. Got him coming home from the track one night. Caught him good with a tire iron. When he woke up, I held him down while Frank cut his head off with a hacksaw.
Silent as a mouse pissing on cotton.
If you like, we could arrange to have that same thing happen again. I don't know that we need to be that overstated.
I love it. They're like, well, we have many other options on the menu.
I like
we
the
could
idea.
Cut his balls off and shove it down his throat. We could put hot wax on his eyes and then push him down the stairs. Like, it's just like
I like the fact that both of these guys are both clearly on death's door, but like their greatest joy in life is reminiscing about past murders.
Recounting the murders that they did and just being like, you know what'd be great? My bucket list is doing that again. Like these guys are fucking, they're very creepy, and it's a very funny scene because I mean, Syl and Chrissy are the ones who go over, and they are clearly, you know, they're the conduits for the audience. You know, we get kind of like, they feel the way we feel watching it, and just like watching Chrissy, as soon as they leave, he looks back at one of them, and the guy does finger guns at him, and he just like puts his sunglasses on and like scratches the back of his head and leaves. It's like fantastic, like nonverbal, just like body acting, just beautiful, chef's kiss. So Johnny Sack decides to call off the hit when he leaves his home but forgets something. He drives back and he sees Jeannie Sack, in the basement, shoving a bunch of candy into her mouth. And they have this very sweet scene where he just says, you know, I never asked you to be thin for me. And it's weird because he goes from like 0 to 60 in sweetness. Like he does a 180 completely in his mindset. First, he's yelling at her like, do you know what you've done? And then he's like, I love you, which is like a weird, it's,
you know what you've done. You've reminded me that I love you.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And then I guess he doesn't go to Boston, and that's the only reason the hit doesn't happen. Right.
Yeah.
Like, is that like, it's weird. Cause like the other one's at least called off, but like,
right.
it's sort of a dangling thread where it's like, all right, I guess, maybe I hope he never goes to Boston because these guys are, lying in wait somewhere. Maybe they're just off screen. Called them and were like, yeah, we're good. It's like, no, it's like, we'll do it for free if you want, you know, or whatever.
And that's the thing. You meet a few different hitmen. You meet the Atwell Avenue boys, but you also meet this Asian guy who is in the elevator, who's right about to kill Ralphie, and then gets the call right then that they're calling it off. And that to me is probably the most menacing scene, in the episode. It's just like watching Ralphie. You know, and Ralphie never looks more, I think, vulnerable and helpless than when he is in a robe, having and flip-flops, having just come out of a pool and just kind of being stared at by a fucking young, muscly Asian dude who you know is strapped and is like ready to fucking murder him. That was, all the tension just kind of just gone.
Right.
But all in all, you know, the episode just kind of ends with the, you know, the fact that everyone saves themselves. Ralphie is saved. Johnny is saved.
Yeah, their own better Nothing nature saves them, because obviously that's what you want to happen in a Sopranos episode.
It's as close to farce as this show gets. It's like it's like Sopranos Frasier, where it's like they bought the wrong sherry or something, but instead they called in hits that they probably shouldn't have called in or something.
Right.
It's very,
I mean, you know, all in all, it's probably, the worst Sopranos episode in, fucking in this season. So I would say solid B+.
Yeah. That's my rating, solid B+.
Patrick, on a scale of B+ to B+, what would you rate this episode?
Yeah, I was going to say, I haven't been rewatching or anything, so I don't have a lot to go off of. I enjoyed it, but it's my first time back with the gang in a while. I'd say B+. I had fun, you know, and it's weird because the Ginny Sack joke is something that I remember. This is before I was watching it when this aired. Like, I was aware of this plot line, even though it ends up being kind of inconsequential.
Yeah.
Like, it was that was like a water cooler thing for some reason. Like
right.
That, yeah. You know, like that plot line, even though it ended up being a big nothing.
Yeah. Same. Yeah. The same memory.
Yeah. It is. It is something that kind of lives on in the lore of the show. You know, you kind of like you remember this incident with the joke. And even though it's kind of anticlimactic in this episode, it is still, you know, it this episode still has its moments that I like. And if we're doing favorite, least favorite, I have to say that my favorite scene is Johnny Sack trying to order a hit on Ralphie and Carmine being like, no, I'm not going to do that. Why would I do that? It's like, he dishonored my wife.
Yeah, right. Yeah. No, I think I have a clip of that.
Fucking kidding me.
Violated my wife's honor.
Ralph slept with Jenny?
He insulted her. He made a very insensitive joke about her body to some friends of ours.
What did he say?
Have to repeat it? Her word's not good enough?
Not if you want him clipped over it.
He said she was having a 90-pound mole removed from her ass. The implication was that her ass is so big she could have a mole that size removed from it.
I love having to explain the joke.
Yeah.
It's like the worst part of it is that he has to live with the indignity of not only telling the joke to people, repeating the awful slur on his wife, but then explaining why it was bad is just, I just love it so much.
It's such a funny thing. Every time he retells it, there's different degrees of people trying not to laugh or like maybe not understanding what the joke is at all, like Carmine. But like,
yeah,
Tony, we know, has already heard it, or at least we later find out, like, he was there when he said it, and
right,
like, you know,
right,
he's very much aware. But like, he kind of is like, you know, when he tells him in the trailer what he said or whatever, he kind of has to kind of keep it together, you know. And I think ultimately Johnny Sack probably would think it was funny if it was about anybody else. So it's one of those things where we're all pretending it's not like a good line.
Right,
you know,
right.
Or like, but you know, it's very disrespectful, blah, blah, blah. You know, again, we're a group of murderers and racketeers, but we, you know, you don't insult, you know, somebody's wife's weight.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah.
Cross the line.
I also loved it. I love the Ralphie line. Who does he think he is? Sir Walter Raleigh? That's the big, and it's just like, what is, okay, like the classic, like just dumb, like just smart enough to be a different kind of dumb, like knowing, making like a reference to something yeah, like that sounds kind of, you know, fancy, you know,
yeah, or
calling him highfalutin because he's offended. Like, that's not what that means, you know? Like,
yeah. It's like,
just, you know, perfect.
He's out there starting stuff, tobacco plantations and naming things after the Virgin Queen. Who does he think he is?
Oh yeah, but yeah, I would say that and then also Tony having to explain the joke to Junior is also great. Like that to me is like saves the episode, is just all the different times that the joke has to be explained over and over again, running it into the ground, making it lose everything about it that's funny and turning it into, you know, just something really awful that's been said. So you know,
and you know it killed. Like, that killed.
It did. Everyone loved it.
Yeah, that's like in Master and Commander, it's like the lesser of two weevils right, level. Like, everyone's just going nuts, just like, you know, standing up to like cool off from laughing too hard type stuff.
Vince or Patrick, either of you, do you guys have a favorite scene or a least favorite scene?
I mean, I said my favorite, you know, the line, we reunited 12 crack babies with their natural mothers.
Yeah,
half a dozen crack babies were reunited with their natural mothers. Yeah.
I liked when they were running down the suspects of who talked at the Bing, where Syl is kind of like talking into his box of fries. Like, he has that affectation where he doesn't look up. And So they're going through all the different people, and then he gets called outside to do something, and then Christopher immediately goes and vultures some fries. And
it's like, he immediately steals a fry.
Immediately.
As soon as Syl leaves, he was like, I gotta wet my beak.
And he's literally not being loyal to his capo. That's he's literally not doing the thing that he must do according to his screenplay. It's really something wild.
Yeah. Yeah. That was up there for me too. Love watching the mafia's petty grifts, you know, when it's like, no matter, it doesn't matter how big or how small, if they can skim a little bit off the top, yeah, they will.
You got to get one over on somebody. That's the important thing.
Yeah. Can't turn it off.
Speaking of getting over, it feels like this podcast is over. I don't know. I did the best I could with that segue.
I like it.
Yeah. So solid B+. Patrick, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Where can people find you on the internet?
So I'm at Patty Mo on the most of the social stuff. Instagram, Twitter are the two that I really use. TikTok, I do not have. I made a bad bet and did not get a squat on the username fast enough, and now it's some lady in Italy. So I'm hoping that TikTok just goes away, just so I don't have to worry about it from my like making everything fit completeness kind of part of my brain. So you know, let's hope TikTok just stops being popular. I'm sure that's a good bet for
any second
a
now.
Man in his late 30s to make on something.
It's me, Patricia Moschino. I can't believe this Irish guy. He take all of my screen name.
I mean, pretty much, yeah. That's but pretty I much have exactly the right. TikTok. But yeah, so that's Patty Mo and that stuff, and I'm as they mentioned earlier, What a Time to Be Alive is the podcast. It's you know, you can find it anywhere. It's not a Drake and Future album. We did not do a good job on SEO with that. Although we do get people referring to the show when people say the expression on Twitter and stuff. So that's good. It's twitter.com/whatatimepod. Whatatime.live is a URL that gets you like a link tree of all the stuff. Nice. You know, all our different places. We got a Patreon, all, you know, it's the usual podcast stuff. So definitely check it out. It's me and Eli Uden and Kath Barbadoro. We are all comedians, and we do like the tagline is, we count down the things each week that make you say the thing that's the title of the podcast. So it's like nice. Dumb local news is what I would say generally, but yeah.
Hell yeah. So check that out wherever podcasts are given away for free and or sold. Patreon.com/Fraughtcast for all the bonus episodes. Today we have a new patron on the Pod Yourself a Shout Out tier. Vince, are you ready to give him a mafia name?
Sure, yeah. I got my nickname hat on.
All right. His name is John Desort.
Hey, John Desort. It's Johnny Bag of Donuts. You know that guy?
Crushed it, dude.
Yeah.
Very, very good.
Hey, there he goes. We used to call him Johnny Bag of Donuts.
Yeah, Johnny Bag of Donuts, Desort, thank you so much for joining the $8 tier. And once again, you can do it if you go to patreon.com/Fraughtcast and join the $8 Pod Yourself a Shout-Out tier. Fraughtcast@gmail.com for all your questions, comments, and concerns. Vince, what's the Google Voice number?
415-275-0030.
All right, everyone, thanks so much again for listening. And until next time, don't stop believing.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Thank you.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.